25 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Happy New Year to you from everybody here at WGTD. Today's program is from the archives, an interview first recorded back in 2017.
I know a man by the name of Lafong, Carl Lafong, capital L, small a, capital F, small o, small n, small g. Lafong, Carl Lafong.
No, I don't know Carl Lafong, capital L, small a, capital F, small o, small n, small g. And if I did know Carl Lafong, I wouldn't admit it.
I have a feeling most of you recognize that second voice. It belongs to William Claude Dukenfeld, otherwise known as W.C. Fields. And he, of course, remains one of the biggest names in early movie history. And I have really enjoyed reading a book just written by none other than James Nybar. And many of you know him for the many books that he has written on a plethora of different topics related to the world of entertainment, particularly to the history of film. And James Nybar also knows a great deal about television history as well, just the entertainment field in general. And he has been called upon to write books about any number of Hollywood luminaries, W.C. Fields being one of the most recent. And so I'm very, very excited that we can have a conversation today with James Nybar about this book, the W.C. Fields films, and also talk a little bit about his work creating commentary tracks for certain DVD or Blu-ray releases for some of these old films. And so we have a lot to talk about, and this return visit is long overdue. James Nybar, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Nice to be here, Greg. Thanks.
Ahead of us talking about W.C. Fields and this latest book and the commentary work and so on, because it's been a little while since you've been on, I want you to just recap for us how you became so kind of insatiably interested in old movies and the entertainment world kind of in general. What ignited this for you?
Well, actually, it was just after President Kennedy was assassinated. There was nothing on TV except the funeral, so my parents took me and my brother to the movies. And I was quite young. I was only like in kindergarten, so this was my first movie at a theater. And the movie they took us to was Who's Minding the Store with Jerry Lewis. And it was the theaters back then were these huge ornate palaces with seats all the way up to the balcony. And it was so packed with people that we had to sit up in the balcony. And I heard people just rocking in their seats with laughter at this movie. And my young mind perceived that this silly man on the screen was making all these people happy during an especially sad time. And at that time, my very young mind realized that some sort of magic was going on. So that connected me with comedy, and I started to, back then, for children's entertainment, they would show things like The Three Stooges and Laurel and Hardy and Abbott and Costello and stuff like that. So that's what we all watched. And but I wanted to know more. I wanted to know who these people were, why they did these things. I wanted to know their background. As I grew up, I became more interested. A lot of those people were alive then, you know. This is, we're talking the early 60s, early to mid-60s, so a lot of those comedians were still living, but not a lot had been written about them. It hadn't caught on as classic just yet. They were just the ones that were around at that time.
Right.
And just like Jerry Lewis was a star at the time. And what's great is I later co-wrote a book on the Jerry Lewis films, and we went to Lewis's house to interview him, and I got to tell him this story.
Mm, that's great. And, of course, you are also talking about an era, and I remember that era as well, when there was no such thing as home video.
Oh, no.
And of course, you know, now, you know, people of a certain age, you have to try to explain this world from, you know, feels like something from the horse and buggy era, but where you just had to wait for something to appear on television.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, there was no way you might have heard of some movie or something, but you had no means to seek it out. I mean, there were no DVDs, no Blu-rays, no VHS tapes, and no YouTube. I mean, there were none of the avenues by which now you can seek out just about any film that survives.
Even when I wrote my first book, there was VHS, but there weren't outlets for the movies I was writing about.
Mm-hmm.
And when you wanted to get like a cast list, there was no internet to look that stuff up. Traveling, you had to go to different libraries and stuff. The Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research in Madison would be very helpful in cases like that. And if I wanted to copy the credits off of the film, I'd have to pause the VHS. Well, in those days, you pause a VHS, it's blurry. You can't really see it. So you'd have to run it, type a name, run it again, type the next name, and it was really difficult. Oh, and by type, I do mean on a typewriter. I did not have a computer for my first couple of books.
Wow. So think of all the ways that the world has changed.
Yeah. And it was always snowing, and I had no coat. No.
Wow. What is the first book you wrote?
First book I wrote was just a general overview on movie comedians. That's out of print now.
Okay. And how many books since then have you written?
I'm working on my 23rd, actually.
Wow.
But the first one was written 30 years ago, so.
Right. So in all of the important actors that in which you've been interested and who you've studied and written about, where would W.C. Fields stack up?
Well, he's one of the, like, very great. He's like beyond a great movie comedian. He's like a great humorist at the Mark Twain level. And back in the late 60s and early 70s, there was this huge nostalgia craze. If you look at, you know, general movies from 1973, you got stuff like The Sting, American Graffiti, Paper Moon, all these things, The Way We Were, all these things set during another time. Nostalgia was big. And so during that time, college campuses latched onto the more subversive characters in early films. The Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields were extremely popular among the comedians, and that's when Fields' films became very, very accessible. I remember I set the alarm on New Year's Eve one night. I was just like, boy, I'll bet you 10 years old. And I set the alarm because there was a Marx Brothers movie on, followed by a W.C. Fields movie, but it was like at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was like, ring in the new year with laughs, that sort of thing. But I'm 10 years old. I'm not up that late. So I actually set my alarm, quietly got out of bed, and turned on the TV softly and watched. Now, I had known Groucho Marx. He was alive then and very active and on TV and
right,
so forth.
Right, right.
But I didn't know he was part of a team until now because Chico and Harpo Marx had since died. So I watched A Night at the Opera with the Marx Brothers, which is the only opera I've ever seen, Greg.
What's a start.
after that, a movie called The Old Fashioned Way with W.C. Fields, which was not only very funny, but it's the movie where W.C. Fields does this big juggling scene from his old vaudeville and Ziegfeld Follies act. So it was, you know, more than a trial by fire. I saw one of W.C. Fields' very, very, very best movies, and I'm this guy's great. He's not. He's funny. He can do all these other things. And as you read more about him, how he contributed to the scripts and had creative control beyond a lot of actors at that time, he had quite a career.
Absolutely. And, of course, we often tend to make this really foolish generalization about once upon a time, old movies were all kind of sweet and soft around the edges and rated G, and even comedies, we think of them as being very innocent and very lighthearted. And of course, there is this edge,
yeah,
and this,
oh, sure,
and even a bit of darkness to W.C. Fields and the characters, most of his characters at least, that he portrayed, that's really this bracing contrast to what we think of as the prevailing comedic flavor of that era.
Yeah, well, that sort of thing is misrepresented. Of course, there were wholesome family movies back then, but there were also monsters and cowboys,
of course,
and all kinds of other things going on then, too.
So. Right. But I think it's why, you know, when we watch a W.C. Fields movie, if we're still operating under that kind of misassumption or misunderstanding, he like jolts us awake. And then, of course, we want to look closer at him, and then we start looking closer at all of the films made in that era, and we realize what a rich period this was.
No, absolutely. And, well, even in the old-fashioned way, the first Fields movie I saw, there's this little kid, Baby Leroy, who was in a few different Fields movies. As when he would be interviewed as an older man, he had no memory of working in movies because he was just like 2 years old or whatever. So he would see the films, and he said, I don't remember ever being ill-treated by Fields off camera. On camera, he was sort of a nemesis for Fields. Fields would be sitting there at the dinner table in an old-fashioned way, and the baby would be, like, sticking his watch in molasses and doing all these things. And because people are all around sort of like, oh, look what baby's doing, Fields, yes. And when everybody leaves to look out the window at, quote, a horseless carriage, unquote, because it was set in earlier times, Fields looks around and then reaches over with his hands like he wants to strangle the kid. But the kid has crawled away. It's just an empty chair. So he sees the kid looking around the corner, and he sneaks over and kicks the kid in the butt, and the kid falls down. Well, the kid doesn't start crying or anything. That would take the laugh away. In fact, there's a close-up of the kid kind of like looking at him kind of like, ah. But the fact that a grown man just kicked the kid in the butt, there's a lot of people that moviegoers back then were like, well, that's really subversive and ghastly and going over the edge.
Right.
Nowadays, it's just a gag.
Sure.
But when you put it into context, that's fairly interesting. That movie was made in 1934.
Right. And yeah, and there's something a little bit daring about that. This is 7 seconds of W.C. Fields. I don't remember the film. Sitting at a dinner table, and not a baby, but his young son, they're having some kind of brief little misunderstanding, and so, we'll listen.
What's the matter, Pop? Don't you love me anymore?
Certainly I love you.
Don't you strike that child.
Well, he's not going to tell me I don't love him.
So he reaches like he's going to swat the kid just for that little moment, and it's like, so this is an interesting take on fatherhood.
Well, I could tell you a little bit about that scene. That's from The Barbershop, a 1933 film that was produced by Max Sennett, the classic Keystone person. The kid in that movie said in a biography I read, you know, when you do research, you read all the biographies. He was interviewed for that biography, the kid, you know, as a very old man. And he said that his father told him that Fields was a juggler. So he went up to W.C. Fields and said, Mr. Fields, I heard you're a juggler. And Fields grabbed a pencil, a cigarette package, which he crumbled up, an empty cigarette package, and like another object, and just started juggling those three objects for the kid, just three random objects, just to show him some little tricks. He'd throw them up in the air and catch him and then go back to juggling, and he knew all these different little tricks.
Wow.
So it's neat that you played that scene.
Huh.
That he actually used that little bit of dialogue scene in a silent movie. It was just title cards then, but of course it works much better in a talkie because you get to hear his reaction, like he, you know, and you don't get the visual on the radio here, but
right.
He actually like raises his hand to take a swing at the kid, and that's why the wife says, don't you strike that child, because well, he's not going to tell me I don't love him. So.
Great stuff. We're talking with James Nybauer about one of his most recent books. In fact, is this your most recent book?
Yep, that's okay. The latest one out.
All right. The
W.C. came out in April.
Okay, the W.C. Fields films. And it goes painstakingly through all of the films of W.C. Fields from his earliest silent films through to his last film, which I think was 1941.
That's his last starring film. He had a couple of guest appearances.
Oh, right. Brief little cameos.
Ones,
and,
yeah.
Right. Let's talk for just briefly about W.C. Fields growing up, and his first career, in a sense, in entertainment, which was in the world of vaudeville. Tell us first just a little bit about his life leading up to his life in vaudeville.
Well, there's a lot of different stories. Fields used to like to tell his life story, and he'd make things up, and then it would get printed in books, and then we'd work from those books. But biographies that are more recent have indicated what actually happened. He did have some conflict with his father, and he'd seek refuge at his grandmother's house and things like that as he was growing up. But he started juggling very young, and he would practice and practice and practice different things, and eventually he ended up working on stage in vaudeville and gradually ended up in the Ziegfeld Follies. His first movie was in 1915, and he did this little bit. He did his pool table bit that he had perfected on stage, and it's a movie called Pool Sharks, and fortunately, the film does exist. So many films of the silent era are lost. We're lucky that we have what we have, but the film does exist, so we can see it, and he made a couple of movies at that time, and then it was many years later he appeared in a film for D.W. Griffith, but his movie career didn't really start to get going until the mid to late 20s, when he started to make silent features. In fact, there's a couple of silent features. It's The Old Army Game from 1926 and Running Wild from 1927 that have recently been restored and are being released on Blu-ray soon. And they're from Kino Lorber, a company that does DVDs. And I do the commentary track on each of those. So we have those coming out.
That's great. And we'll talk about that at the end of the hour. I want to find out a little bit about kind of your philosophy about what the kind of thing you try to offer for that. One of the things you mention in this portion of the book about the silent films of W.C. Fields is that in at least most of them, I don't remember if it's all of them, he's actually wearing some kind of weird clip-on mustache. First of all, I can't even picture what that would be like. Like, where would the clip go, or how can you have a clip-on mustache? And evidently, it was very obviously a clip-on mustache, but it was, I think you say, the sort of shtick that was very common in that era, maybe. I don't know if it was common in film, but maybe common in vaudeville or something.
It was just like, part of a character, and it's like a lot of them had mustaches and really garish facial features and so forth in the silent comedies, and that's what Fields had. He stopped wearing it after his first couple of talkies. It didn't work, but in some films, it's funny because it's so obvious and so ridiculous looking. It's like it clips on the underside of his nose, in between his two nostrils, and it's just this fake shock of hair that's just sitting
there. Gotcha.
And I don't know why that wouldn't be, annoying to wear when he's working, but he kept it throughout the silent era, and in his first two talkies, The Golf Specialist and a feature where he had a small part called Her Majesty Love. Then after that, he abandoned it, and we know him better without it.
Right. So in the silent films, and of course, I know a number of them do not exist at all. They seem to be entirely lost.
Yeah.
But some of them do exist, and in some ways, it's almost impossible to imagine W.C. Fields without that inimitable voice with which we associate all of his comedy. How effective was he, in a sense, without his voice in these silent films?
That's a really good question because, back in the late 60s, early 70s, when his films were so accessible, people started to write books about his work, that was popular, so it was selling. And I read about all these silent movies he had done, but they were not accessible back then. Mm. And I would think to myself, how could he be funny in silent movies? He's a very verbal comic.
Right, seems impossible.
I didn't stop to realize that as he's being verbal, he's also very physical. Well, the way he would react, startled, or the way, like I described before, when he would reach over like he's going to strangle the kid and see that the kid's not there and do a double take. All of that was so organic to the character that it just sort of blended in with the dialogue, and I never ferreted that out to examine it by itself, because I'm just a kid growing up watching these things.
Sure, sure.
Well, years later, as an adult, the silent film started to become more accessible, and I watched them, and like the two that I did commentary on that I mentioned, They're very funny movies, and he was a very funny comedian in silence. The competition was pretty fierce. Even at the same studio, Paramount, they had Harold Lloyd, who was amazing. Mm-hmm. So the Fields films didn't catch on as big as perhaps the studio might have liked. But looking at them aesthetically, they hold up really, really well. They're very funny movies, and he's very funny in them without the dialogue.
Right. And, of course, they must have been effective to some extent in that W.C. Fields, once he was a big enough star in the talking era, wanted to go back and remake some of those silent films. And if they hadn't been worth anything, he probably wouldn't have bothered.
Yeah, he would remake the films, and they would usually be more effective as talkies simply because it adds that other layer, that other dimension to his character when you could add dialogue. But taking them in and of themselves, they're fascinating and funny movies on their own. And it's also interesting that there's one scene that he does where he's trying to go to sleep on the back porch, and things keep interrupting him and bothering him. Well, in a silent, it's all done with visuals. There's a close-up of a baby with his mouth open real wide crying. Well, we can't hear the crying, but we can understand that there's crying. And then the shot of Fields, like, tossing and turning, and then coming over and trying to quiet the kid by, putting his hands around his neck and shaking and stuff like that. Well, in the talkie, they could use very noisy things, like somebody drops, I think it's like a melon out of a grocery bag, and it rolls down the stairs, thump, 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 at these perfect intervals, like tap, 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 and it shows Fields like trying to sleep, oh, God, like, the look on his face.
Right.
And so it's really fascinating to see how this scene was done in a silent and how it was done in a talkie. Some of the gags hold over to the next thing, but very separate gags, they're just as funny as each other, but in very different ways because different approaches. And that's what makes the sound remakes of silent films that much more fascinating.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, when we read this portion of your book, how he's not spectacularly successful right off the bat in movies, nor does he, I think if I remember correctly, he makes a couple. And then a long stretch of time, I mean, years go by before he makes his third film. So at the outset, there is no clear indication that, oh my gosh, this guy's going to be a superstar in movies.
Well, that's because he was primarily a stage comedian. And of course, back then, before social media and all the rest, big stage stars like him were really well known on the coasts. But in the middle America where we live, well, it's not going on around here so much with that stuff. So he was just another guy in a movie to them. Mm. He wasn't W.C. Fields, the Ziegfeld Follies star. Well, they could advertise that, but people in middle America are like, yeah, okay, well, how good is this movie? And even if the movie was funny, well-received by moviegoers, not a lot of people went. It wasn't making a lot of money. Those who went really liked it, but there wasn't that come-on, that attraction that, it's a Rudolph Valentino movie, a Douglas Fairbanks movie. Well, a W.C. Fields movie didn't have that sort of impact on moviegoers just yet.
Right.
So he was primarily a stage star who dabbled in movies. And, of course, back then when movies were coming out, two and three a year by an actor, when you make a movie and you go away for a couple of years, that's like an eternity.
Yeah.
So you have to let it catch on.
Sure. Do we know very much about exactly what he did on the stage in his vaudeville days? I mean, I know certain bits he did showed up in his movies.
Yeah.
But otherwise, is it possible to know with any precision or certainty exactly what he was like or exactly what he did on stage in his vaudeville days?
Oh, sure. He did, the juggling at first, and he had little bits that he would add that people would find amusing, and so he gravitated towards comedy in all of his different bits that he did.
So, for instance, when he'd be juggling, he'd also be, cracking jokes and stuff?
Not so much cracking jokes, but he'd have a guy there that would throw him the ball when he's juggling, and then he'd bounce the ball off the guy's head and catch it and bring it back into the juggling.
Okay.
It was very visual at first. He would add dialogue later on. He would do a pool table bit where which was repeated in a couple of movies, and that had some dialogue in it. And then later on he would do little bits like the comic supplement, which is some sketches that he did that were funny, including the trying to get to sleep outside. That was done on stage, too,
okay.
along with in a silent movie and a sound movie. So when you watch W.C. Fields films, you really see a lot of his entire career replayed before your eyes.
Right.
And you get to appreciate the range he had as a performer.
That's cool. Speaking of range as a performer, we should mention also that he was on Broadway, that he was in at least one fairly significant show, Poppy, I think is the name of it. And you also tell us something that I had no idea. And I know something about Showboat, but I hadn't heard that Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein II had him in mind for the role of Captain Andy.
Yes. He couldn't take the role because of, you know, various circumstances that are discussed in the book. But, he was who they had in mind when they created that character.
Wow. So that gives us something about... tells us something about his level of renown as a stage performer.
Yeah.
If you were going to have somebody watch one silent film by W.C. Fields, which one would you have them begin with?
Now, these are such difficult questions because it's like, you know, what rock and roll song in the history?
Right.
Well, let's see. For W.C. Fields, Silence, I think I'd have to go with Running Wild, which is one of the ones about to come out on Blu-ray, because I think that's his funniest. It was reworked slightly as a talkie called Man on the Flying Trapeze, but not completely. It isn't a complete remake. It's just the basic idea. In this film, Fields plays a very meek, put-upon guy who's henpicked by his wife, his second wife, and her son, who is his stepson, is just a terror. And it's not a little kid. It's a guy, like, in his 20s, who's acting like a little kid, and that sort of thing. And he's got a daughter from a previous marriage. He's a widower, and she's the only one who sticks up for him and so forth. So that dynamic is used to some extent in the later film. But in this movie, which is not in the later film, he is running away from something and runs into a vaudeville theater and ends up on stage with a hypnotist. And the guy hypnotizes him into thinking he's a lion. He's a tiger. And so he goes around and he ends up getting a raise at work, securing a big contract for the company and getting a bonus, goes home and takes over and, you know, redecorates the house, pulling pictures down. And he gets even with the kid. You know, they show him grab a strap and then grab the kid, go into a closet, and then come out, and the kid's running away. And so all that goes on, and it's really a very funny, like, worm-turn sort of comedy that I hope more people see when it's accessible on DVD.
Hmm. We're speaking with James Nybauer about his most recent book, which is called The W.C. Fields Films. So tell us how he does, and evidently he does it very well, in making the transition from silence to talkies.
It seemed like a natural transition, but because his movies were not big money makers in the silent era, the studio that released them, Paramount, wasn't real crazy about hiring him to make sound films. And there was a guy working there that was pretty high up that had a lot of respect for Fields called William LeBaron. And he said, "No, this guy is going to be good. I think we can take a good chance on this." But his first few sound films, they'd pair him with somebody else. Alison Skipworth, a very funny actress, would be paired with him in a movie called Tilly and Gus, for instance. Mm. Or he'd be in an ensemble thing like International House, where among the other stars were Burns and Allen, Bela Lugosi, Stuart Irwin, all kinds of great people. Rudy Valli, the singer. So he had to pretty much establish himself before they started to give him his own movies. Hmm. But once they did, I already talked about the old-fashioned way. There's another movie called It's a Gift where if I was backed into a corner and had to tell the funniest comedy feature from the 1930s, I think I might choose that one.
Hmm.
And that's, you know, there's many contenders you can imagine. I mean, from the Laurel and Hardy and the Marx Brothers all the way to Joe E. Brown, there were some wonderful people in the 30s. But I think I might have to say It's a Gift is the most consistently funny movie from that extremely rich period.
One of the films that intrigued me the most as I read this part of the book was a movie called Million Dollar Legs.
Yes.
The big ensemble, and you just mentioned, I think, International Hotel or International House is another example of that, where W.C. Fields is one of kind of a plethora of major performers, but he kind of shines out there. And then you also talk in the book about how he was paired in a lot of films with a guy. Was it Chester somebody?
Oh, yeah. That's in the silent era. Chester.
Oh, that's still the Chester? Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Right after he did Running Wild, they tried to pair him up and see if he could work in a comedy team dynamic.
Kind of like Laurel and Hardy, I suppose. That
in a way, yeah. They were Laurel and Hardy were really popular at that time because they had just teamed up around that time. But Chester Conklin goes all the way back to the Keystone comedy.
Oh, okay.
Very
that's
funny
right.
guy. But they made three movies together, and all three of them are lost. So we can't assess how good they might have been.
Interesting.
Or how bad, for right. that matter. We don't know.
But at some point, it sounds like W.C. Fields sort of put his foot down and said, it's not that he was saying, I'm the star, but at some point I think you tell us that he kind of said, you know, I think I'm going to be more effective if I'm not always paired with somebody, if I'm given a chance to be kind of the main focus.
Yeah.
Am I remembering that?
Yeah, that's essentially correct. It's Paramount just didn't want to take a chance on putting him out there alone because that didn't really work before, and so they were trying other things. But once he was established with movies like Million Dollar Legs and International House, they kind of let him go on his own, and that's why we have Old Fashioned Way and It's a Gift and Man on the Flying Trapeze and so forth.
Right. I noticed that sometimes W.C. Fields is given credit as the screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
How often did he do that? I mean, once he's established as a star in the talking era, was he the screenwriter most of the time, much of the time, some of the time?
Well, I don't know that he knew the dynamics of screenwriting, as it were, but he would contribute to the screenplay significantly because they were using so many gags that he created for the stage that were used in silent films, and also some original things that he was coming up with. But he just had some particular ideas at how to best create his character and present his character, and so as he grew as a performer, he was allowed more creative control.
Hmm. I noticed that when you talk about his performance in the film David Copperfield,
yeah,
which is based on the Charles Dickens work of the same name,
yes,
you make specific mention of the fact that in this movie, W.C. Fields basically does no ad-libbing at all, that he remains very faithful to the script, and that suggests that most of the time in all of his other films, he was not particularly true to the script. Can you just say a word about the ways in which he would play loosely or deliver very freely the scripts he was presented?
Oh, sure. Well, with David Copperfield, he played Micawber. And that was originally supposed to be played by Charles Laughton, who didn't feel that he was effective in the role. And Fields coveted the role, but he worked for a different studio. So they, you know, MGM had to take him and so forth. And he went over to MGM and did that film. And he was respectful of the Dickens novel. And so he played it straight and was very effective in the role. Mm-hmm. But for his comedies, that's his house. That's, you know, that's not Charles Dickens. These are things where it was essentially his concept, his idea. And even though a screenplay was written, he would have some supervision over that screenplay. He would contribute greatly to it. And on the set, if he came up with something, he would ad-lib something. There's a movie he made in 1934 called You're Telling Me, where the juvenile lead is Buster Crabb, the old Olympic swimmer who later played Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers on the screen.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I had the pleasure of knowing Mr. Crabb back in the 70s. He died in the early 80s. And I asked him about working with W.C. Fields. And he said he would drink all day and never show it. I don't know how he did it. And he said, and when he would ad-lib something, it was funnier than what it was in the script.
Hmm.
So those are things that probably happen fairly frequently. But there's a guy that was on the set with him, in the movie with him, that responded.
He would make it work somehow.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, it sounds like for the most part, he was fairly professional on the sets and generally speaking, a pretty good colleague and fairly cooperative. But you certainly mention a number of cases where, for instance, he would really cross swords with directors really have strong ideas about what needed to happen and was not reluctant to speak up. Talk for a moment about the kinds of issues that would typically maybe rile him up or bring out this facet of his personality.
There are sometimes certain pet scenes he would have that would slow down the action, according to the director.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
He doesn't care that in the context of the movie, it doesn't fit, it might slow down the action, it might disrupt the flow or the rhythm, and the director has to adhere to something like that. Well, if Fields doesn't get to do his scene, he's got a movie star or showbiz ego, and he'll just walk off the set and go home, and then, well, there's money that's being made, and there's contracts and everything else, and so that's holding up production, and a lot of times they would shoot the scene, and then they would cut it out later, and so Fields would see the preview, and the result would be he wouldn't promote the film very well. One of his best films from 1940, The Bank Dick, I've read interviews where he dismisses that as one of his worst films. In fact, it's lived on as one of its best. Sometimes they're not the best judge of their own material.
Right. I think you said that probably the experience he complained about the most, or the role that he complained about the most out of everything, was the role of Humpty Dumpty in Alice in Wonderland. Yep. So first of all, I didn't even know this movie existed, although there's a still of it in your book.
Yeah.
And I feel like, oh yeah, I think I've seen that shot before. But I didn't know anything about this movie, and it sounds like for W.C. Fields, for a couple different reasons, it was a real nightmare.
There were so many great stars in the movie, and Charlotte Henry starred as Alice, and they tried to do something with the material, you know. And unfortunately, Fields, the makeup was uncomfortable. He was claustrophobic under it, this huge hood that they put under and this thick makeup for Humpty Dumpty. And he didn't like working in the movie, but that's at a time where he hadn't established his stardom just yet, and they were still putting him in ensemble pieces, and this was the next job he had, and so he had to do it. But he didn't have to like it, and he just, you know, basically...
and didn't.
Yeah, he found it to be very difficult. And overall, the film... Now, I have a couple assistants I work with, Terry Lynch, who's in Kenosha, who lives in Kenosha, and Katie Carter, who's out in St. Louis, works very closely with me. And Katie liked Alice in Wonderland better than I did when we worked on, because they live every book with me, film by film. And Katie liked the film, so it's made me look at it a little bit differently, because I thought it was just, you know, an unmitigated disaster when I saw it. But when Katie pointed out some of the better cinematic points and the better connections to the Lewis Carroll material, I got a little bit better reaction to it. But, yeah, Fields, that was a terrible experience for him.
We're talking with James Neibauer about his latest book called The W.C. Fields Films.
Listen, you've all got to realize one thing, that I am the master of this household.
Harold?
And the, yes, dear?
This is a... great little, tiny little moment, but it points to something that you talk about W.C. Fields really thinking was one of the sort of his richer opportunities as an actor on the screen, playing the henpecked husband. Talk for a moment about just how commonly or how often we would see this particular sort of character being played by W.C. Fields and the way he would play with it and bring so much out of it.
He would do it so brilliantly. You'd actually feel sorry for the character. You know, there's a certain pathos that would be going on in movies like It's a Gift and Man on the Flying Trapeze and The Bank Dick, where he was dealing with this dysfunctional, shrewish family and tried to assert his authority, and he was never able to do so. It is very effective in Man on the Flying Trapeze, one of his most brilliant films, but it's most effective in the It's a Gift, which, once again, is, I think, his greatest work, his masterpiece.
Hmm. I thought it would be interesting to also hear just a little snip from something that I believe is an example of you know, older work that would reappear again. And this had something to do with W.C. Fields on a golf course. And in fact, I think you tell us some of the earliest footage of W.C. Fields talking is from some of this golf material.
Well, in all the books you'll read about W.C. Fields, they say that his first sound movie is The Golf Specialist in 1930. Well, I discovered through research that he actually appeared in a newsreel before doing The Golf Specialist. And my friend at Ron at the Vitaphone Project had footage that he sent me of some raw footage of Fields performing in this newsreel. And he does have dialogue. So he talks on screen before what is always known as his first talkie. And, yeah, he does do his golf routine, which he had done on stage.
Here's just a little bit of W.C. Fields, in a sense, on the golf course.
Over again. Don't stand behind me when I'm shooting. You told me to stand over there, sir. Never mind where I told you to stand. You stand where I tell you. That kid's so dumb, he doesn't know what time it is.
Say, by the way, what time is it?
I don't know. 10:15. Shut up, will you?
Okay, now, when we look at that, that's from a movie called The Dentist, where the opening scene is on the golf course, and then the later on is in the dentist's office. And when he says, don't stand behind me when I'm shooting, he's talking to his caddy. And then he says of the caddy, the kid's so dumb he doesn't know what time it is. Then his golf partner, played by Bud Jameson, says, by the way, what time is it? He says, I don't know. And the caddy pipes up, 10:30, shut up, will you? And so that's why, without that visual, you don't see exactly who's saying what.
Exactly.
But the dialogue itself is very funny.
Yeah. And I got to say, James, you just blow me away with your ability to hear 30 seconds of dialogue and immediately you know what film it's from and its context and so on. That's very, very impressive. The last little bit I want to play are two little snips where whoever W.C. Fields happens to be playing at the time is kind of expressing some of his thoughts about women, the fairer sex.
Why don't you take your wife home a present, a little pet of some kind? Women are crazy about pets.
They're just crazy. Pets haven't a thing to do with it.
I'm a married man with a grown daughter, 18 years of age.
Oh, I'd like to meet her. I'm very fond of children. Girl children, around 18, 20.
Okay, that's from two different movies.
Right.
The first scene is from a movie called You're Telling Me. Well, he's on the outs with his wife, and he's in the pet store when they say, you know, get a little pet for your wife. And
oh, yeah, women are about crazy about pets. Yeah.
Well, he shows him like a little canary, and Fields goes, it will take a bigger bird than that to make my wife happy. The very next scene sees him running down the street with an ostrich on a leash. That great visual. And the ostrich is running down the street and, like, dragging Fields along,
yeah, right.
Bringing him home like he, you know, he takes a bigger bird than that. Of course, he comes out with an ostrich.
Right.
That's so funny.
Oh, hilarious.
And the second scene about I'm very fond of children, girl children, 18 or 20. He's talking to an actor named Franklin Pangborn in the movie The Bank Dick, a very funny movie.
Yeah. And this is probably as good a time as any to mention that in certain cases I can think of two cases, at least in your book, where a certain scene in a W.C. Fields movie might disappear the next time that movie was released, it might be snipped out of it because it was a little too risque, a little too suggestive.
Absolutely. You just played that golfing clip from The Dentist a little while ago. In a later scene in The Dentist, there's an actress named Elise Cavanna, who he worked with all the way back to, I think, On Stage. A friend of his, in fact. And he's trying to pull her tooth, and it's really stubborn. So she's got her legs wrapped around his waist. And, of course, she's wearing a skirt. They weren't wearing pants then. And he's, like, trying to pull on it, and he's walking around with her legs around him. Well, in 1932, people are like, well, what the heck? You know, it was considered like, whoa. Well, that's called the pre-code era, before the production code was enforced. And that, but then in that it was enforced in 1934. Well, in, I think, 1936, they re-released The Dentist, and suddenly it was only half its length. It was only 10 minutes long instead of 20, because they cut that whole scene out. And they also added music in the background. So when later reconstructions of The Dentist came out, they would restore that scene, but they never would wipe away the music in the background, which is also annoying. Mm. So the one reconstruction that is worth it is on a Keystone collection, because The Dentist was produced by Max Sennett. Hmm. So there's a Max Sennett collection that came out on Blu-ray, that has like a whole history all the way back to the early silent era. And Charlie Chaplin makes an appearance, Fatty Arbuckle, and they go all the way to Sennett's talkies, and that has a good reconstruction of The Dentist the way it was meant to be seen. Hmm.
Very good. So we made brief mention earlier that you actually have created the audio commentary for a Blu-ray release that is not yet before the public, but soon to be released. Just tell us the experience of doing that, and maybe a little bit about what your philosophy is when you provide the commentary for these films. And this is not the first time you've done that. You have other commentaries, I think, to your credit.
Actually is the first time. I have another one I did after that on a Jerry Lewis movie.
Right.
But the two that I did for the W.C. Fields films, they were my very first ones.
Okay.
And first of all, it's great that Kino Lorber comes out with these wonderful films from all different eras. I mean, they do a lot of like contemporary indie stuff, and they also do silence and talkies and just a plethora of great films. They just came out with a bunch of Bob Hope movies, for instance, on Blu-ray. Well, they restored a couple of W.C. Fields silents, two of his best, Running Wild, the one that I said was the best of his silent features, and It's the Old Army Game, two very funny movies. And I, for doing the dialogue, the commentary track that they asked me to do, there's two different things I felt that needed to be done. Background information on the actors, so, you know, biographical stuff. Not just on Fields, but some of the supporting actors, because some of them are people that did something. Louise Brooks is the leading lady, for instance, in It's the Old Army Game. So there's some background going on there, and the director and so forth. But sometimes it's what you're seeing with the person that's viewing. It's like, okay, look at what the director did here. Look at this establishing shot here. I know... without trying to sound too pedantic or academic or whatever, there's a cinematic process going on. There's an art form being developed.
Of course. Here.
And I wanted to respond to that as much as background information, biographical information, the fun trivia that you can bring up about the making of the movie. But, look at this tracking shot here. Look how effective this is there. Look where he places the camera. Little things like that is fun to point out as well.
Absolutely. And I applaud you for that, because I get very irritated with movie commentaries that don't do that, where they're just kind of talking endlessly and seemingly oblivious to what we're watching on the screen at the time. And so it sounds like you really pay attention to the movie that the viewer is watching, and are really going out of your way to try to enhance our appreciation for the movie at hand.
Yeah, I'm watching the movie and commenting on it, essentially, and bringing up things that I think are impressive and why this is a great movie, why it's an enduring classic.
So what are those two movies again that you've done the commentary for that we should watch for?
It's The Old Army Game and Running Wild. They'll be coming out from Kino Lorber. I'm not sure when, but they're restored on Blu-ray. They look beautiful.
Wonderful. And this latest book, W.C. Fields Films,
yes,
which is a painstaking examination and celebration of the many films of W.C. Fields, and one only laments that he didn't live longer take better care of himself so he could have lived to make still more films. And I, for one, coming into this with little, if any, real appreciation for who W.C. Fields was and all that he accomplished, I feel like I know so much more since reading your book, and I'm excited to seek out many of these films and enjoy them. I should have done that a long, long time ago. James Nybar, a great, great pleasure to have you here, and I promise we will not let 2 years go by before your next visit, and I know